Well, good morning. My name is Mark. I'm one of the elders here, and I'm really happy to be bringing the sermon to you today. So in case you haven't noticed, this is an election year. It is a very interesting election year. There are many, many things that I find interesting about this election cycle, but one that I've been thinking of a little bit lately is particularly what this election in particular reveals about our notions of power and control. Power. You know, there's lots of rhetoric going back, and no matter who, you know, no matter who you're going for, what side of the political spectrum you are, there's a sense of great investment. Who's going to be in? Who's going to be out? Which candidate? Which set of ideas will, you know, gain the ascendancy? And, you know, what lies behind this, if you ever stop to think about it, is the assumption, and it's true, is that this is an incredibly powerful office we're talking about, President of the United States, considered to be the most important, the most powerful, you know, job in the world. And so I want to use this just to get us oriented to what we're looking at today. In other words, power, greatness, what it means to be powerful, what it means to be great, what it means to be strong. We are nearing the end of our series on the Gospel of Mark. And today's passage that Jenna just read speaks to this issue of power. It shows us what power and greatness are to look like in the Christian community. In other words, what it means to be great. The title of the message is True Greatness, and we're going to see three things in the text today. We're going to see the desire for greatness, the way of greatness, and the great one. The desire for greatness, the way of greatness, and the great one. Number one, the desire for greatness. Now, just a little bit of background here. The Gospel of Mark, you know, I love the Gospel of Mark. It's just so simple and stark and clear. The Gospel of Mark, boil it down, is about two things. Gospel of Mark is about Jesus and what it means to be his disciple. It's about Jesus, who he is, Son of God, Son of Man, you know, what he came to do, to live the perfect sinless life and to heal and work miracles and die on the cross and rise again. And it's about what it means to be his disciple, be his student, be his follower, how to live the life that he calls his followers to live. It's about Jesus. It's about discipleship. And the particular feature of the Gospel of Mark is usually these two ideas are found together. Usually who Jesus is comes right next to who his disciples are to be. And this is a great example with this passage today, because three times in the Gospel of Mark, Jesus predicts his death and resurrection. And in the couple of verses just before our passage, verses 32 and 34, you can read it, Jesus for the third time in his gospel predicts that he's going to, you know, go to Jerusalem and he's going to be mocked and beaten in this and he'll be killed and crucified, and then the third day he'll rise again. And these predictions of his death and resurrection are always followed by a reaction on the part of his disciples, a bad reaction. And that's what we see here, you know, James and John. And this is on purpose. You know, this is to show, you know, a couple things. Not only does it show us that the disciples, you know, don't quite get who Jesus is really, you know, before the resurrection, but the other thing in this passage today, these serve as models. These serve as examples. They serve as a teaching moments for all future disciples of Jesus Christ. And so with our passage today, Jesus reveals himself and what he came to do, and now there's a teaching moment that comes out of that. So let's take a look at what happens. So, you know, once again, verses 32, 34, we didn't read it, but, you know, Jesus predicts his death and resurrection. And then right away, verse 35, it says, James and John, the sons of Zebedee. James and John, they're elsewhere called the sons of thunder. These guys must have been a rip to be around, man. They're just, you know, like you get it from this passage and other, these guys were, you know, sons of thunder. Like, that's quite a nickname. But it says that they came up to him. Now, this word, this is the only place in the Greek New Testament where this word is used. It indicates something. They came up to him. It's the idea they're sidling up to him. They're like, psst, hey, Jesus. We got to talk to you. You know, this is on the sly, you see. They come up to him, goes out of its way to say. And they say to him, Teacher, we want you to do for us whatever we ask. And he said, Sure, what do you want me to do? And they say to him, grant us to sit, one at your right hand, one at your left, in your glory. Now, what's this about? You know, the good news about this passage is at least, you know, the disciples, James and John, get that Jesus is a king. You know, he's the Messiah. And what they're saying is, we know you're the king. We know you're the Messiah. We know you're, you know, going to be enthroned in your sort of messianic kingdom there, and we want in. We want in. Right and left, we want high positions of power in your kingdom. We want, you know, vice president, secretary of state. That's what they're asking for. High positions of power. Now, Jesus' reaction is interesting. I find his reaction very, very interesting. Look at this. He doesn't exactly rebuke them. He doesn't say, like he said to Peter back in chapter 8, he doesn't say, get behind me, Satans. You know, he doesn't say any of that. He kind of works with it. And really what I think he does is he redirects their request. He redirects their request. You know, let's see what he says. He says, first he says, you know, you don't know what you're asking. Are you able to drink the cup that I drink or to be baptized with the baptism? You know, are you up to what you're asking? The cup and baptism, these are, of course, metaphors, images. The cup in the Old Testament is an important image of God's judgment being poured out, an idea of suffering. And baptism, of course, the idea of going underwater, being overwhelmed with the troubles and sorrows. Are you ready to suffer? You know what you're getting into. And, you know, the sons of thunder, oh, yeah, definitely. We are able. I love these guys. And then Jesus says, well, I got some good news and bad news. Good news is great. Because you're able, good, you will drink the cup that I will drink, and you will undergo the baptism with which I'll be baptized. In other words, yes, you will suffer. But, he says, here's the bad news, to sit, you know, the thing you asked, to sit at my right hand and my left, sorry, it's not mine to give, it's for those to whom it has been prepared. Now, what I want to see is interesting reaction. He doesn't exactly rebuke, he redirects. And this is subtle. You know, I don't want to push this too far, but what I think this indicates, he's not saying don't be great, in other words, but he's using this to show them what greatness looks like. And what I think this means is that there is a sense in which we are made for greatness. There's a sense in which we're made for greatness. Where am I getting that from? Genesis chapter 1, all the way back in the beginning. Go back to Genesis 1. God creates Adam and Eve, our first parents, and he places them in the Garden of Eden, and he gives them a mission and a commission. And he says in Genesis 1:28, says, God blessed them, and God said to them, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth and subdue it. Have dominion over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the heavens and over every living thing that moves on the earth. In other words, we are created, you and I, to rule as God's vice ministers on earth, to fill the earth with God's glory, to exercise power and dominion for God's sake. In other words, isn't it ironic? The thing that James and John are asking for is something that, in a sense, was intended for all of us, for humanity, from the very beginning, to fill the earth with God's glory, exercise power. Psalm 8 says this, what is man that you are mindful of him, and the Son of Man that you care for him. Yet you have made him a little lower than the heavenly beings and crowned him with glory and honor. You have given him dominion over the works of your hands. You have put all things under his feet. Power, dominion, but not for our sake, but for God's. But of course, it goes wildly wrong. Wildly wrong, very early on. Adam and Eve sin. They choose to, instead of fulfilling this commission, they choose to glorify themselves. The Hebrew word for glory literally means weight. They choose to ascribe weight and glory and honor to themselves rather than to God. They choose to be the ones that call the shots. They resent the limits on that God has placed on them. They want to grab power for themselves, be great in and of themselves. Have weight in and of themselves. And my friends, this same sin, this same tendency to grab power, this cosmic glory grab, is our story ever since. It's your story and mine. And the Bible says that because of their sin, two consequences. Number one, they're exiles. They're kicked out of the garden. And so you and I, we're in a place, we're in a world that, you know, where there's sort of a sense of, you know, we're exiles. We're in a world that we're not meant to be in. Something's not right with the world. And the Bible also said this, that says that they're slaves. We are slaves to sin because of this cosmic glory grab. And so our desire for greatness always goes wrong. It always goes wrong. You know, and almost like you can almost pick at random, you know, from movies and books and literature and life to see examples of this. You know, the Godfather movies, okay, a Godfather, right? So Michael Corleone, right, if you know the story, he's like the good son who doesn't want to go into the family business. He doesn't want to go in. He wants to go his own way. And he gets pulled in, right? He gets pulled in, but he says, no, with me it'll be different. In 5 years, he famously says, we'll be legit. No more of this stuff. No. You know it doesn't work. It goes wildly wrong. It gets worse and worse and worse. And there's awful effects on him and his entire family. It just affects them. J.R.R. Tolkien. Here's my more geeky illustration. J.R.R. Tolkien. Not a lot of people know this. Tolkien began and abandoned a sequel to The Lord of the Rings. Did you know that? Lord of the Rings, right? The movies, books. Lord of the Rings, you know, what better, like, epic, happy ending could you have where the king returns and, you know, the evil is banished from Middle-earth and, you know, the bad guys are dead and it's beautiful and the king and all this stuff. He starts writing a sequel, which is supposed to take place about 100 years after. He said it was too depressing. I had to stop because he knew what would happen. A good author knows what will happen in the world he creates. He says, I knew it would happen. The line of Aragorn, you know, the king has descended into internecine squabbling and they're fighting, you know, there's infighting and so forth. And, you know, there's pettiness and there's evil is abroad in the land and the children of Gondor are playing at being at orcs in the streets of the city and all this stuff. He said it was too depressing. Franz Michel was a 20th century political theorist. Here's my highbrow illustration. But I did read the book. 20th century political theorist. He writes a book in 1917, think about that year, called Political Parties, 1917, the year of the Bolshevik Revolution, USSR. And in the book, he codifies what became known as the Iron Law of Oligarchy. The Iron Law of Oligarchy. You can Google it. And what he says, it doesn't matter your system, it doesn't matter, you know, your intentions, whatever political party, what happens is it always devolves into oligarchy, the rule of the few. In other words, the aspirations for, it doesn't matter the system, it doesn't matter the intentions, our aspirations for power and greatness always devolve into mediocrity or tyranny. You know, power corrupts, absolute power corrupts, absolutely, but it's not the power. We know it's not the power. It's us. It's in us. Now what about us? You know, I don't know that we plan on running Gondor or, you know, a mafia syndicate. I hope not. You know, what about us? You know, of course, we're more. It's more subtle with us. It's more subtle. You know, in your job, your place of business, you know, the sense of climbing the ladder that we all deal with. We're in a place of business. There's a power structure. You start, you know, you're low on the ladder. What do you want to do? You want to climb up the ladder. Instead of seeing your coworkers as people made in the image of God, people to whom you could share God's glory and goodness, what do? We use them as sources of social capital that we can gain and we can acquire for ourselves. Some of you know I lived in Afghanistan for many years in the mid-2000s. I was doing aid work there. And somebody told me when I first moved to Afghanistan and started working with Afghans, they said, you know, and frankly, it's not just Afghans, it's everyone. They said, when an Afghan meets you for the first time, they want to know, it's a very stratified society, they want to know, are you above me or below me? Are you above me or below me? Where do you stand? You know, they want to peg you. You know, what do you have? Now, of course, not just everyone, we're all like that. Aren't we all like that? You know, climbing, who do we express love to? Do we express love to, you know, to everyone equally? Do we seek out, you know, the broken and the hurting? Or do we express love and spend our time and attention with those who can, you know, do stuff for us? This happens at churches. I was talking to a pastor friend who confided in me and said, yeah, you know, I have to really watch it. He said, if I'm not careful, I will fill up my time, my social time, with people from the church who are the cool people in the church. You know? Even in churches, you can get this. You know, if you're a student, especially if you're a student, oh my goodness, you know, the you know, clickiness and the ins and who's in and who's out. And this can happen in a study group. You know, it doesn't take much. It's our story. It doesn't matter who you are. It doesn't matter your situation. We're made for greatness, but it always goes wrong. Jesus shows us another way, the way of greatness. Let's take a look at verses 41 to 44. So Jesus and James and John have this side conversation, and then apparently, you know, word about stuff like this always leaks out. So when the 10 hear of it, they began to be indignant at James and John. Now, you have to ask, why are they indignant? You know, are they indignant because of this just such a bald grab for power? Or are they like, why didn't we think of that? You know, I mean, we don't know. It doesn't say. But they're indignant. And so Jesus says, okay, before this gets out of hand, he calls them to them and he says to them, you know that those who are considered rulers of the Gentiles, you know, lord it over them, and their great ones exercise authority over them. But it shall not be so among you. The ESV doesn't do justice to this. The Greek literally says, it is not this way among you. It's very stark. It is not this way among you. In other words, like when you and I say, that's not happening. We use the present tense to declare something that we wish to be. It is not that way among you, he says. But whoever would be great among you must be your servant. And whoever would be first among you must be slave of all. In other words, true greatness consists, Jesus says, in laying down our lives to serve others. Jesus calls us to become great by serving as Jesus served. He calls us, you want to become great, he says? Serve as I serve. The two words he uses here, servant, slave, very strong words. It's hard to understand the sense of them. The servant, the word for servant here, was the ordinary word for someone who waits on tables in the Greco-Roman world. Now, you and I, all right, they're a waiter. Okay, that's not a bad job. You know, maybe some of you are waiters. It's a good job, depending where you work. You work in Center City, make some good tips. No, a very low-level, you know, thing in this culture. Not a job you want. And slave, of course, absolute bottom of the social ladder here. It's, you know, this is hard for us to get how radical this is. You know why? What do we call our public our politicians? We call them public servants, right? Do you know why we call them public servants? Because of this passage. Because of Jesus' example. It's true. We call our politicians public servants because of the Christian influence still in our culture. See, so it loses the shock value that it's meant to have. It's kind of like saying, you know what this is like? This is like saying, you want to be president? Here's what you do. Drop out of the race and go become a trash picker in a slum somewhere. That's how you become great. That's how you become president. That's how radical this is. Jesus is redefining greatness by showing us that true greatness consists in laying down our lives to serve others. And we become great by serving as Jesus served. Become great, not by grabbing glory and honor for ourselves, but by serving as Jesus served. How do we do it? Well, I'll just throw out a few areas of application here, see what might apply to your situation. So for example, let's talk about the job situation, the ladder climbing, any place where there's a ladder and you're on the ladder. What Jesus is saying here is saying, I've come to flip the ladder. Jesus flips the ladder. He says, if you want to be great, go all the way to the bottom. In other words, giving time and attention to those who lack social capital, those who don't have anything to give, maybe the new person at your job or the person who's on the outs at your job, treating everyone as equally worthy of love and worthy in respect because they're made in the image of God, spending time, if you're a student, with the student who's on, that kind of weird student who doesn't seem to be getting on with people who lack social capital, the people who aren't cool. You know, imagine if, you know, at your work or at your job, you became the type of person who goes out of your way to spend time to talk to people who are lower than you on the social scale, to talk to them, get to know them, get to know their issues, seeking to do the jobs that no one else wants to do. Or think of it this way, become the type of person about whom people say, gosh, I cannot imagine this place without them. I could not imagine this job, this school without them. Become great by serving as Jesus served. Of course, we can do this in marriage and family and our personal relationships. Look, let's face it, the Christian ideal of marriage is one of radical service to one another, where both husband and wife, in different ways, just radically lay down their lives to serve one another. If you're a parent, I know we have a lot of parents, especially of young children in the church right now. If you're a parent, or if you're a caregiver, especially if someone who does not give a lot back in return, I just want to tell you, God sees your service. It is very, very precious to him. I know it's a very difficult thing. It's something that goes unrewarded, and you do things that nobody else sees. You pour out and pour out, and it's just really hard. And I just want you to know, any act of service, no matter how small, if done for Jesus' sake, it is of inestimable value to him. It has not gone unnoticed. It won't go unrewarded. How about the church? If this passage is true, and if the local church is God's primary way of manifesting his glory and goodness in the world, then we can't not be involved in serving in the local church. Now, you guys at City Light, like, totally preaching to the choir here. Do you know what our volunteer rate is at City Light is? I just checked this week. It's like 50%. It's 50%. You know how amazingly high that is? Most churches, 10, 20% of the people do all the serving and volunteering that goes on. But 50% still means that like about half of you still aren't involved. So I just want to say, you know, the local church is like a primary place where we want to be pouring ourselves in. We have tons of ways you can get involved. Sunday team, prayer team, worship team, logistics, parking, city groups. It goes on and on and on. The Easter outreach, lots of great opportunities. If you are not yet volunteering at Citigroup, I would say like put that on the Connect card. I want to volunteer. We would love to get in contact with you. Something for everybody. This also applies to leaders. It definitely applies to leaders. You know, I want you to know, I'm just going to put this out there, like Jesus is setting a standard here that Christian leaders ought to be held to. And you as the people of City Light Church, you have a right to hold your leaders to account on this. And if we're not living this out, you come talk to us. You have a right to do that. Become great by serving as Jesus served. Or another way to think of it, Dixon Host, he was a missionary to China. He said this, seek to be forgotten that Christ will be remembered. Seek to be forgotten so that Christ will be remembered. C.S. Lewis in his book, The Great Divorce, it's one of my favorite little books by him. It's a little novella. It's about 100 some odd pages, great book. It's a story about like if a group of people who are in hell could take a day trip to heaven in a bus. That's what it is. It's a story. I don't, you know, don't go too far with the theory. It's just a story, okay. And, you know, but Lewis wants to highlight the choice that all people make eternally between finding joy in God or finding joy someplace else. And so Lewis himself is a character in the book. It's like a dream. And he has a guide. George MacDonald, the Scottish 19th century author, is his guide and, you know, sort of his tour guide in heaven. And towards the end of the book, they're kind of chilling out in heaven, and it's a plain. It's this grassy place. And they see this procession come into view, this bright procession with a woman at the front, and there's animals and people like all around, and they're dancing. And C.S. Lewis thinks it's Mary, you know, it's Mother of Jesus. And so he asks his guide, George MacDonald, who is this, you know? And the guide says, it's someone you'll never have heard of. Her name on earth was Sarah Smith, and she lived at Golders Green. In other words, she's a lower-class Londoner. And Lewis says, she seems to be, well, a person of particular importance. Aye, she is one of the great ones. Ye have heard that fame in this country and fame on earth are two quite different things. And Lewis asks about the people surrounding her, and MacDonald says, every young man or boy that met her became her son, even if it was only the boy that brought the meat to her back door. In other words, even if it was only her barista. Every girl that met her was her daughter. Every beast and bird that came near her had its place in her love. In her, they became themselves. And now the abundance of life she has in Christ from the Father flows over into them. Don't you want to be like that? I want to be like that. Fame in heaven, which may look very different from fame on earth. Seek to be forgotten so that Christ will be remembered. Or seek to become great by serving as Jesus served. Now look, all that sounds great until what? Until you actually try to do it, right? Okay. Now try to do this and wow. Richard Wurmbrand, one of my absolute top Christian heroes. Richard Wurmbrand, if you've never heard of him, you should check him out. He wrote a bunch of books. He was a pastor. He was Romanian, Lutheran pastor in the 20th century. He died in 2001. He spent, I don't know, about 10 years in communist prisons in Romania for his faith, 2 years in solitary confinement, being tortured with like the worst, like most disgusting tortures that human beings could devise. He wrote books about it. He actually got out, he came to the United States and testified back in the 50s, 60s before Congress. He took his shirt off in Congress, probably the only person that ever did that. You could see the scars on his body from the torture. I had the privilege of hearing a radio interview with this man in the 90s before he went to be with the Lord. And in the radio interview, the interviewer asked him, did you find it hard to forgive your torturers? Did you find it hard to forgive your torturers? I will never forget his answer as long as I live. He said, no. He said, no. It wasn't hard to forgive my torturers. They come in. He said this. They come in. They torture you for half an hour. And then they leave. He said this. He said, how hard is it to love the people you live with day in and day out? He said this. To continue to show up and show love to people, you know, when they don't notice, when they're not, you know, giving you the love and respect and honor and glory that you think you deserve in return. And you know this. This is our story. You try to serve. You do this. You're doing this. And you say, oh, but they don't notice. I'm serving and serving. They don't notice. You know, I changed the diaper last time. You know, they didn't notice. I got up with the baby. They don't notice. I've filled the Brita filter 5 times this week. Darn it. And so what do? So we try to alter our tone of voice, you know, to we don't want to be so quite so obvious to indigo. You know, you haven't. We do all these little games, all these subtleties, because you know it's not working and people aren't noticing. You know, that sinking feeling we get. The fact is, even serving, especially serving others, can just be one more thing we do to bring glory and honor and weight to ourselves. It's true. This is the human condition. I had the experience of knowing not one but two people, Christians, both men, who were amazing servants. Everyone who knew these guys, first thing you'd say is they were servants. But I lived with both of them. I saw them up close. You know, these guys, they would always leap up and volunteer and do the job no one wanted to do. They would always, if you were at dinner, they would pay for the check. If they were guests for dinner, they would leap up as soon as dinner was done and they would, you know, clear the table. And even if the host said, no, 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 you single ladies are like, oh, are these guys still single? I want to meet these guys. It wasn't like that. It was not like that. And it wasn't just me. People who were close to them noticed there was something a little weird about these guys. Like they had to do it. You got the sense over time they weren't doing it for you. They weren't even maybe doing it for, you know, for God maybe, that they had to do it. They were doing it for themselves. Even serving can be just one, you know, just one more way. It can be twisted. It can become an occasion for pride and bringing weight and glory and self-glorification. And my friends, if this is true, who can save us? Well, we know the answer. The great one. The great one. Let's look at verse 45. Jesus, in concluding the passage here, says, for even the Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve, and to give his life as a ransom for many. Son of Man, possibly single most misunderstood title for Jesus in the Bible. Son of Man. If you're like me, when I was young in my Christian walk, people said, oh, all right, there's two big titles for Jesus. Son of God means that he's divine and he's the Messiah and he's like exalted and huge and awesome. Son of Man means he's, you know, man, he's human, he's humble and meek and meek and lowly and this and that. No, 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 no. That's not right at all. Son of Man is a title, commentators universally agree, comes from the Old Testament, from a particular place in the New Testament, Daniel chapter 7. Let's read together what Daniel 7 says about the Son of Man. Daniel 7, 13 and 14 says, and behold, with the clouds of heaven, there came one like a Son of Man. There it is. And he came to the Ancient of Days, that's Yahweh, and was presented before him. And to him was given dominion and glory and a kingdom that all peoples, nations, and languages should serve him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion which shall not pass away, and his kingdom one shall not be destroyed. You see, far from a meek and lowly figure, this Son of Man is an exalted figure. That's why it says in Mark 45, it says, even the Son of Man came not to be served. You see that? Even. They expected the Son of Man to be this exalted, you know, figure. He's saying, no, even the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve. And to do what? Lay his life down as a ransom. A ransom. What's a ransom? We know what a ransom is. It's a payment that delivers from bondage. In the biblical context, it refers to a payment to deliver the people of Israel out of their exile and out of their slavery to sin. The prophet Isaiah, 700 years before Christ, writes of the ministry of the ultimate servant. And Isaiah says, behold, my servant shall act wisely. He shall be high and lifted up and shall be exalted. He was despised and rejected by men, a man of sorrows, acquainted with grief, and as one from whom men hide their faces. He was despised, we esteemed him not. Surely he has borne our griefs and carried our sorrows. Yet we esteemed him stricken, smitten by God and afflicted. But he was pierced for our transgressions. He was crushed for our iniquities. Upon him was the chastisement that brought us peace. And with his wounds we are healed. All we like sheep have gone astray, and we have turned everyone to his own way. The Lord has laid on him the iniquity of us all. Jesus Christ comes, the exalted Son of Man, not to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for you, for me, to pay for this constant need and desire we have to bring glory and honor and weight to ourselves. So in other words, what I'm saying is Jesus is not just our example how to be better servants, but he is also the one who frees us from our slavery to sin so that we can be truly free to serve others. The gospel frees us from our slavery to sin so that we can become great by serving others. So the gospel doesn't just free us to serve, it actually changes the way we serve. We're freed from the need to glorify ourselves. We're freed from the need constantly to be noticed when we're serving, because our service is no longer something we're doing even primarily for others. It's no longer we're doing for ourselves to bring glory and weight and honor, but we're doing it for him, because we've already received God's favor because of what Jesus has done on the cross. And we're doing it for his sake as an act of worship. About a week after this little interaction here with James and John, Jesus would go to the cross. He wouldn't be sitting on a throne. He would be nailed naked to a Roman cross for all the world to see. He didn't have his vice president and secretary of state on his left and right. He had two thieves on his left and right. As the letter of Philippians says, he humiliated himself even to the point of death, even to death on a cross. At the cross, Jesus took our desire to bring glory and honor and make ourselves great so that we could become people who are freed to become great for his sake. So let's come to him, broken by his love shown for us at the cross, and through the freedom we find in the gospel, become great by serving others.